Okay, we're going to get started with this presentation. I'm talking about Alaska's economy, why we need a comprehensive fiscal plan for Alaska, and why they're talking about broad-based taxes currently in Juneau. First, I want to give you some of my credentials. I have a Bachelor of Arts in Government with a minor in Economics. It's relevant to this discussion, but more importantly, it's so that I can point out that it's a BA in government, not a BS in government. But also because the best education I ever got about Alaska and issues is when I was in the legislature. I spent 12 years in the legislature, and I can tell you that's a very dynamic process. You're inundated with information. In our system of government, we elect people, whether at the council level, the assembly level, or say legislature level, to digest that information, sort through it, determine what's good and bad information, listen to the discussion and the debate, and try to make informed policy decisions on behalf of all of us. And so it's a tremendous information in all kinds of things, not just the access to the information, the expertise, and the consultants, also listening to the questions other people with different perspectives ask during the committee process and things like that. All of that is an important part. And it really gets to why we have in our republic a democratic process where we elect people to represent our interests. And it's because they are supposed to, they're as part of their responsibility, to do all of the things that you would like them to do in terms of how they make their decisions, because we all have our lives to live, our jobs, our relationships, our families, our health, our hobbies. And so we put the burden on them to make those decisions for us. I'm hoping that this will help broaden the debate. It's a lot of that discussion is going on now in Juneau, and I'm hoping that we can help broaden the debate a little bit, because I think it's important to Alaska's economy. This is the problem. About a $2.8 billion annual state deficit and no easy answers. The options that we have are the same options that we had available in the past. Budget cutting, taxes, whether it's sales, income, oil and gas, or others, and permanent fund earnings are going to be a part of any solution, and economic development is often talked about as an option for how we get more revenues to the state. So with respect to the options, budget cuts are much easier said than done. There's 735,000 people and at least that many different opinions. We have different priorities for state spending, philosophical differences about government. Political rhetoric often exacerbates those differences, and everyone worries, or many people worry, about it hurting the economy. Here's the challenge. You know, I talk oftentimes about the fact that we really do get our priorities right most of the time. In the state budget, our biggest single expenditure is for education. Same thing at the local level. But of the $4.4 billion budget this year, almost 1.3 of it is for education. Oil tax credits have been, I didn't change the slide, but they've been dialed back a little bit, and I think that we'll see more of it dialed back again this year. Retirement benefits are constitutionally required, and we've changed the retirement systems in Alaska significantly. Some of what's talked about with the unfunded liability for retirement programs dates back to what's called a defined benefits program, which we had in place all the way up until I think the final change was in 2004, where we went to define a truly defined contribution system. So it's now new employees to the state have a it's like a 401k process. The other one is health and social services. The bulk of that goes to Medicaid. And while I think there needs to be some changes made to Medicaid, I'm glad that the governor expanded Medicaid when he did. That was the right decision. And we have to be cautious with Medicaid spending, how quickly we change that, because even though I think there's some efficiencies that can be made and changes, we get at least a dollar for dollar from the federal government. So it's an important part of our overall economy.
In my way of introduction, I'm Larry Pursley, the Chief of Staff to the Borough, and I just want to explain, people, I think it helps when you talk about the budget gap and how we're going to solve it and what are the numbers. This is sort of a simplistic, just break it down, what do we get, what are we spending, and what the options are to fill it. So on the far left where it says current, total state general fund spending, operating budget, debt service, school funding, Medicaid, everything in there, debt service on school bonds or on state bonds, a little bit more than $4 billion. Of that, that top 1.1, that's what we get from oil. At today's production, in the vicinity of today's prices, production tax, royalty, property tax, corporate income tax, we're pulling in about $1.1 billion for the state general fund. The next little blue line, the $500 million, that's what the state of Alaska general fund makes from everything else other than oil and gas. That's corporate income tax, and the next three biggest taxpayers, smokers, drinkers, and insurance premiums, oh, and motor fuel taxes, fees, licenses, everything else other than oil and gas, tops brings in about $500 million to the state general fund. So the gap is at 2.9. That's what we've been drawing out of savings last year, this year, give or take a little bit depending on prices. So you think, I got that $2.9 billion gap assuming oil prices hang out where they are. What are your options? You could take all the earnings from the permanent fund on a given year and almost fill it, but that would be no dividend. So if you want the $1,000 dividend, if you think that's the right amount that you got last year, you can, that costs about $650 million. So as you think about permanent fund, to do the full dividend as is in state law prior to the governor's veto last year, that's about $1.3 billion, $1,000 dividend, save $650 million, and the earnings after the dividends, you know, $1.4 billion. So no dividend, you can almost fill the gap, you want a dividend, half the dividend as you had last year. You can maybe get a couple billion from the permanent fund earnings, but you still got a gap of $900 million to $1 billion. How can you fill it? New oil certainly would be our dream. It's just a number, it's a guess. If some of the new fields come back on or come on, depending on prices, depending on production, depending how much it costs to develop that oil, and Mike will talk about that later, new oil is always a lot more expensive than old oil, which means it pays lower tax rates. Maybe, optimistically, you might get $250 million from new oil production. There are some in the state Senate who want $500 million in budget cuts. That number there does not represent an endorsement of $500 million in budget cuts or a statement that it's plausible or responsible. It's just, well, if you want to close a $2.9 billion gap, you could cut $500 million from the budget. But as the mayor said, it's not easy. And then an income tax or sales tax, the numbers being kicked around, $500 million, $600 million. So that kind of gives you a sense, budget cuts, income sales tax, new oil, permanent fund earnings, kind of where your options are to fill that hole of almost $3 billion.
So what's different today? Well, here's what's different today. Oil production in Alaska peaked in 1988. It's been trending down ever since. There's been a couple of bumps upward from time to time, but overall production has declined significantly since 1988. Now, it's showing out into the future that it's going to continue to decline. There's still a lot of oil in Alaska. There's still a lot of opportunity in Alaska, but in order to get to additional production and development of fields, it takes significant capital in investment. And so I think we can get additional revenues out of oil and gas, but things have changed. Here's how things have changed. If you look at that first slide on the far left where it says U.S. oil production, in 2005 the prediction was oil production would continue trending downwards because of tight oil and fracking in the lower 48. What we've seen is at one point the U.S. was the number one producer of oil in the world. Now we're number three, I think, behind Saudi Arabia and Iran, I think. But we're expected to become again the largest producer of oil in the world. The middle slide is LNG imports. In 2005, the prediction was we'd be importing gas, LNG gas, because of a demand. But the reality is because of, again, fracking and oil discoveries and the technology kept catching up in the lower 48, we're now going to be a net exporter of natural gas. And in terms of total U.S. energy imports, in 2005, the prediction was that it was going to continue climbing. The reality is that we're almost self-sufficient in this country. This is why it's changed. And this is significantly different. This is unconventional resources, which means it's what's called tight oil and shale oil. And the technology is now caught up, but look at the size of these fields that we're talking about. The Permian Basin, which is there in West Texas, 50 to 115 barrels of oil equivalent.
Billion.
Billions. Did I say millions?
No, you said 50 barrels.
Oh. Billions of barrels of oil equivalent. That compares to the North Slope, which was originally 15 billion with 9 billion recoverable. We've now produced, I think, almost 16 billion barrels because of technological advances. So that's a comparison. Eagle Ford, more than twice the size of Prudhoe Bay. The Bakken is a very large one. And then over on the far east coast, the Marcellus Basin, that is trillions, 400 trillion cubic feet of gas, compared to the North Slope estimates of 150 trillion cubic feet of gas. So it's significant, and it's why the dynamics have changed and the paradigm has shifted in oil and gas. Doesn't mean we can't get money out of oil and gas, but what it means, this is where we're competing with investment for oil company investment in Alaska. Now we're competing not with Saudi Arabia and other places in the world like it used to be. Now we're competing with a stable political environment, the same as ours, because it's in the United States. That used to be one of the big things that helped attract investment.
And in that same context, when you think back, 1988, 2 million barrels a day off the North Slope, and this gets to the competitive issue, you know, at the peak of production, it took 5 workers to produce 1,000 barrels a day of oil. As the fields decline, they're older, it takes more work, there's less oil. Now it takes 30 workers to produce that same 1,000 barrels a day. A good example is, when Prudhoe Bay was really productive at its height, some of those wells were producing more than 90% oil, less than 10% water. Now some of those same wells are doing more than 90% water, 10% oil. A lot more work just to get the same number of barrels. That affects competitiveness and whether we're an attractive investment or not.
The other thing is those fields and that infrastructure is much older than when it started, and so maintenance costs have gone up. Now, with respect to the options on taxes, after 2 tax-free generations, the income tax was repealed in Alaska in 1980. We need to be able to talk about taxes and why taxes aren't all evil. There's a rationale behind them. But there's deeply held philosophical differences about taxation. Political rhetoric often exacerbates those differences. In this country now and in this state, we're often too polarized in our politics, when in fact we need to be to get together to figure out rational solutions. And it takes time to implement anything. If you put a new taxing structure in place, whether it's sales tax or income tax, or even statewide property tax, which people down here don't want to hear about right now, it requires time to get those structures put in place. And we worry about hurting the economy and people. This slide I've just put in here to show where we are in terms of broad-based taxes at the state level. We don't have any statewide property taxes except in oil and gas. We don't have any state general sales taxes or income taxes, and that's why we're on the far left in terms of the tax at the state level, what we pay in state taxes. That's not in and of itself a good reason to raise taxes. I'm just showing it as a example of where we fall in the states, other states. Well, the other option is permanent fund earnings. Again, public perception and anger over any changes, a fear of political consequences of using the earnings, a smaller dividend, but hopefully a sustainable dividend, worry about impacts to the economy and on individuals, and fear that doing nothing could hurt the economy even more. And I wanted to put this slide up here to talk a little bit about the permanent fund, because the permanent fund dividend is very popular, but there's a lot of misunderstanding about the permanent fund itself, when it was set up, what the purposes were, etc. And there's some discussion and debate about that, but of the 57 billion currently in the permanent fund, 46 billion is what's protected, and the corpus of the fund is protected by the Alaska Constitution. 11 billion is currently in the earnings reserve. Included in that is the fact that they haven't inflation-proofed the fund for the last 2 years, instead have kept that in the earnings reserve until we figure out where we're going. There's a lot of talk also about the fact that if the public hadn't done this, we would have spent it all. We would have wasted all that money. The reality is the permanent fund was initiated in the legislature. It was, and when Governor Hammond was governor. So what's constitutionally dedicated to the fund, of what's in the fund now, 40% came from what is constitutionally mandated to go into the permanent fund. 40%. 40% came from legislative action to inflation-proof the fund. That means they took some of the earnings and put it into the fund so that it would be protected. Another 20% came from legislative transfers of surplus oil dollars when we did have some surpluses. We didn't just spend it all. In terms of why the permanent fund was set up, I've read some of the history. I've talked to a lot of people. I actually served in the legislature with a number of people who were in the legislature at the time it passed. Talked to Sam Cotton just recently, and really the big part of the rationale was to take a portion of the non-renewable resource and turn it into a long-term renewable resource. Everybody knew at some point, just like that decline curve showed, at some point it was going to decline. Oil production was going to decline. That's what happens. And so it was to try to set aside some of it for future generations. There was no determination at the time the constitutional amendment was passed for a dividend. It came about several years later, 4 years later, I think, at Governor Hammond's initiative, in order to try to get focus and attention put on the permanent fund. So all that the constitutional amendment says is, this money is going into the permanent fund, and it's available at the discretion of the legislature. Doesn't say exactly that, but it's available to the legislature, earnings of it. What's in the corpus of the fund, or the principal of the fund, cannot be touched by the legislature. Earnings every year, though, can be. So the dividend and inflation proofing both are spending decisions. And while I think there's good rationale for having and continuing a dividend, because the subsurface resources in Alaska are owned under our constitution, are owned in common property by all the people in the state, except for leases before 1958. They're owned in common property by the state, and I think that argues in favor of paying out a dividend that can be used to help support the economy and to support residents. But we can't just spend all of the earnings of the dividend, or all of the earnings of the permanent fund, on dividends. There is no responsible fiscal plan that I have seen that doesn't use earnings of the permanent fund as one of the components of a plan. The other option that's always often talked about is economic development. You know, we don't need taxes, we just need more economic development. It's broad public support for economic development, provides opportunities for jobs, positive economic impacts on communities, but does it really help the state's fiscal situation? So I wanted to put this out there. This is from fiscal year 2016, and what it shows is transfers from the state to the Kenai Peninsula Borough, a total of almost $104 million in fiscal year 16. Most of it, as you can see, went to education, the retirement programs, and which is a component of education and pupil transportation. So economic development on the Kenai Peninsula. Is it good for the Kenai Peninsula? Is it good for Alaska? And will economic development save us? I put this slide in here because it is a purely made up scenario, but it's based on the tax rates that we have in the Kenai Peninsula borough. The assumptions for the hypothetical economic development scenario are that the development proposal on the Kenai Peninsula must be approved by both the state and the borough, and the state and the borough must both determine if the proposed economic development makes good fiscal sense and decide yes or no. So the proposal is for a new widget manufacturing plant that wants to move to the Kenai Peninsula. 10,000 new jobs would be created, 10,000 new families, 5,000 new students for the school district, 10,000 new homes would be built at an average assessed value of $200,000 per home, and $1 billion in capital investment by the Widget Manufacturing Company of America, LLC. And the reason it's an LLC is because limited liability corporations or companies in Alaska don't pay income taxes. Corporations do, but LLCs do not. So with respect to the Kenai Borough's decision, we get about $5 million based on the sales tax revenue we have now, $5 million a year in additional sales taxes, $20 million in borough and service area property taxes, $10 million a year in borough and service area property taxes on the capital investment. In terms of higher expenses, we're just using education, and we haven't applied a multiplier to it to at this point. It makes things even worse, but this demonstration will show you what I think the point I'm trying to get across. So with 5,000 new students, that's about a 50% gain over our current school district enrollment. Two-thirds of the costs are paid for by the state. So the other third, our match for additional 50% based on our contribution to education, another $27.5 million in expense to the borough. So the borough decision, the math on it is $35 million in additional revenues, $27.5 million in increased costs for the Kenai Peninsula borough. The decision is $7.5 million additional available. It adds up. So our decision would be, it's a winner. Yes, we would want to see that economic development. It's good for the borough. It's good for our communities. And it provides opportunity. So our decision is yes. Now for the state. For economic development in the state, there's zero new revenues. From an investment like this, there would be zero new revenues. State's additional expenses, and I think these are probably underestimated a little bit, but nevertheless, $10 million a year in higher expenses for troopers, highways, courts, prisons, Medicaid, child care assistance, all kinds of expenses that we see for expenditures at the state level, and another $45 million a year in increased school funding costs because they pay the bulk of our educational costs. So the decision for the state is $55 million in additional expenses, no new revenues. So for the state, it's a loser. It makes the fiscal gap even wider at the state level as a result of significant economic development. So the state's decision would be no. And so under this scenario, borough's decision would be yes for all those reasons. The state's decision should be no, because we go further in the hole. And it's why we're talking now broad-based tax. Without a broad-based tax, economic development could actually make the state's fiscal situation even worse. And then that's a Standard & Poor's credit rating agency says, according to state income, by introducing a statewide income or sales tax, those are the broad-based taxes, the state could generate several hundred million a year in unrestricted revenue. In our view, therefore, the state has sufficient potential fiscal resources if it can assemble the political will. And that's what we're talking about now, is the whether or not the political will is there. It might not happen all at once, but the education process and the evolution towards a sustainable budget and fiscal plan for Alaska is critically important.
So working off that hypothetical that the mayor laid out, what if you get a new industry, new jobs, they come to Alaska and you've got to provide services, what revenues do the state get, what expenses is the state responsible for? So these are some numbers prepared from the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research, and they're hypothetical, they're average, but if you think about the average resident, and these would, we're looking at newcomers who come here for new economic development, smoke a little, drink a little, drive their truck around a little bit. On average, the state general fund will get about $260 per person, because again, there's no income tax, sales tax, property tax on residents. Total, if you had 500,000 adults, population now is about 735,000. If you had 500,000 adults, total, those individuals will pay about $150 million to the state general fund. If you look at the expense side, for every new student, take highway, trooper, court expenses, divide it by those 500,000 adults, it costs the state about $3,100 in services per capita versus that $260 income. And it was fine for two generations because we lived off oil. Without oil, you got to look at the math, and the math is every new resident costs a lot more than the state general fund gets out of it. It's a non-sustainable mathematical formula, and I was not a math major. I failed calculus. I started in chemistry and was failing in that, and someone said journalism was a lot easier major, so I switched to the journalism school. Well, it was either that or drop out. So anyway, that's the math. Roughly, hypothetically average, it just doesn't work.
So this is what is expected. We're going to have prolonged discussion about, you know, some people don't want an income tax, some people don't want dividends cut, some people don't want the budget cut, nobody wants sales taxes, and so we're just going to pull in opposite directions. It's difficult. So no wonder it's so difficult. We all bring our own biases, experiences, and philosophies to the debate. When multiplied by the governor and his staff, 60 legislators and their staffs, then adding in the population of Alaska, factoring in talk radio, political parties, election dynamics, the media, right and left-wing splinter groups, lobbyists, special interests, and a multitude of constituencies for every item in the budget, the problem just doesn't seem all that difficult. So we've put together the perfect plan, and here it is. There is no perfect plan. In fact, we're going to be talking about the levels of budget expenditures. We're going to be talking about what, how much to spend on education, how much to spend on public safety. We're also going to be debating what types of taxes and which, whether it's oil taxes, statewide income taxes, statewide sales taxes, motor fuels taxes, all kinds of things we're going to be debating. We're going to be talking about how much of the earnings of the permanent fund to use and how much of a dividend can be and should be sustained. And there's talk, you know, about whether or not we can get more money from oil, and the truth is, yes, we can. We can get more money from oil, but in order to get additional investment in the opportunities and the fields, the really good conventional oil fields, that's the difference between us and those basins I showed you in the Lower 48. They require more wells to drill, even though it's cheaper and it's closer to infrastructure. They require more wells to drill. So on a well basis, we're kind of on an equal footing, but we have an 800-mile pipeline that we have to transport it down and then put it on ships before we can get it to our markets. And so it's a significant, in order to attract capital investment to develop those fields so that we can get up to production again, on some of those additional North Slope fields, it's going to require investment. And if we try to put too much of a burden on them, it becomes a disincentive. And as long as we have a gap between what we're spending and how much we're taking in on an annual basis, it's going to be a disincentive to investment, not just in oil and gas, but to everything. I just put this slide in here. It has nothing to do with the presentation, but we're getting to the end of the presentation. I wanted to soften you up for
and questions. He's not a cat person.
Oh, it's cute.
So now I'm happy to answer or try to answer your questions. Thank you for coming out tonight.
Thank you, Mike. That was great. So whenever we're talking about the income for Alaska, we're always talking about dirty types of revenue and the effect that it has on the environment. And I'm always so disappointed that in the presentation it would say, okay, this, But this is going to be the environmental consequence when we stay with our old-fashioned way that we've been doing things. So I know you're open-minded and you understand climate change, ocean acidification, and sea level rise. I'm reading a book called High Tide on Main Street. I would advise everyone to read that. Real fun, of course. But I do want to just ask you about that. Are you taking anything about Hillcorp or anything, or are we sticking to this?
No, I'm happy to answer your questions about anything that you'd like to talk about.
Okay. So the environment is really important, and for me, I always want to have economy and environment even, so that when you discuss the economy, the consequences to the environment get talked about just as strongly, and how much it's going to cost us to clean up the oil spill when sea level rise takes our everywhere away, blah, blah, blah. And then Hillcorp, I'm very, very disappointed in the old system, the pipelines. And personally, from my environmental view, they shouldn't even be used anymore because they're so old. And I'm so disappointed in Hillcorp, and I don't even know why the state allows them to be here. We would be thrown in jail if we were doing what they're doing. Thank you, Mike. Okay. You did a great presentation.
Thank you. I'm gonna tackle the alternative energy first. And you know, there's been great advancements that have been made in batteries and the storage of batteries. There's also in some of the wind technologies, solar technology, all of those have advanced. But the slide I showed about how much oil is available, one of the things that happens is that when you have prices of energy, one type of energy drop, it's compared to other types. When the price of oil is really high, it means that more funding and actually it becomes economic to look at alternative sources of energy. When it drops, it's less of an economic incentive to do that. So, you know, when we talk about the decisions that we make in this state going forward, one of the things that's talked about for a gas development and oil development is taking a portion of that revenue stream and making sure that we can provide energy to rural areas of Alaska where they have very high a cost of energy. You know, and that's one of the policy decisions that should be made, is that, you know, a portion of that should go into alternative energies and trying to get us more self-sufficient in that manner. But the reality is that economies and companies who are looking for returns on investments go to where the oil is. And we have good rocks in Alaska. We also have good coal. However, you know, the irony is that for a long time, the U.S. was reducing its carbon footprint by shipping our coal to other countries. And from a global perspective, it did nothing. And I think that we're moving away from that, our current president notwithstanding.
I don't think you're going to get back to oil back to coal because it's for a lot of reasons. We're not going to get to a lot of coal production because of climate change, all kinds of things, melting of the. So, with respect to Hillcorp, lines and that infrastructure is very old. You know, I grew up in Kenai when that was all happening. When I was in middle school or junior high school, which we called it then, we split shift at the school. There wasn't enough schools. We had so many people coming in to develop that we had to split shift for 1 year or part of a year at least at the middle school. And so it brought in a lot of economic opportunity, and it also brings in a lot of what problems associated with industrial development and in oil and gas. So those pipelines are old. That infrastructure is old. And what we're talking about doing now, in fact, we're just there was a little bit of money left over in CERCAC, a grant that the borough gave to Cook Inlet RCAC in 2001. And they called me about a week or 10 days ago and said, hey, can we use this money? Can we reappropriate it? I said, what money? They said, well, we got a grant from the borough and we still have 15,000 left. I said, Craig, finance director, I said, is there money left in that grant that hasn't been used? And he said, no, we closed that out a long time ago. So I called him back. I said, no, that grant was closed a long time ago. And they said, well, but we have the money. We just haven't spent it. Can we spend it? And I said, well, if you hadn't asked, I'd say sure. I wouldn't have any say in it. But since you've asked, you know, it's one of those things when they were supposed to file a report and then return an amount that wasn't used. But we just put in an ordinance to appropriate that to CERCAC to allow them to do or help do a pipeline integrity study so that we can determine. And you know, the companies, Hillcorp and the other companies, all, it's in their interest. They run the pigs through the ones that they can get through. They put cameras down in them to try to assess where there are problems. But they are old. We need to figure out where we're going. But there could be and would be significant consequences on the Kenai Peninsula in terms of our taxable revenue and our tax base, which means it gets shifted somewhere else unless we see a huge downturn in our population.
Yeah, my name is Mike Hayes. I've lived in Homer for about 13 years. Before I moved to Homer, in my previous life, I was focused on economic development issues, and that's why it's interesting to see your slide there. But the focus on economic development issues was really on entrepreneurship, creating entrepreneurship programs to create economic development. So when I first arrived 13 years ago or so, the oil, I think, had dropped to about $30 a barrel. So I was getting all sorts of invitations to come around the state because of this real problem the state's having to reduce oil prices. Come and teach us how to create these entrepreneurial programs, right? So I would go around the state giving presentations, and then suddenly oil started creeping up again, right? Got up to $40, $50. So did they want Mike Haynes again? They forgot about Mike Haynes, right? So oil rose and they forgot all about Mike Haynes, and then oil dropped again, and where's Mike Haynes, right? So my point being is that you can't construct economic development by turning a switch. It's got to be a concerted program by the state level and the local level over time. And you can't just say, I'm going to introduce economic development and tomorrow it's going to save our problem. You've got to think this on the long term. It's going to take 10, 15 years to do this, but if you don't start sometime, it's not going to work. And I don't see this mentality at the state level saying, we have a comprehensive program to do this. It's this, what are we going to do today mentality? And even though you put that slide up, and the big slides about economic development, and by the way, I don't agree that bringing in a 10,000 person employee or company into the Kenai Peninsula is the way to do it. I prefer to have 100 companies employing 10 people rather than one company employing 1,000 people. Because if that company decides to go elsewhere, the economic impact has got. So my point being is that the mentality's got to change at state level to think broader and long-term on this, to change the dynamics and not forget about oil, but change the direction and think about economic development in another way.
And I don't disagree with you about having small entrepreneurs and having a whole bunch of small companies. The effect is the same, and that is without some sort of a draw on that economic development, the costs, you can't pay for the costs associated with it. And that was the point of it. And you're right. Alaska and you know, because of sort of the polarization of politics now, you know, I've been talking about the need for a long-range fiscal plan for Alaska since I was in the legislature in the 80s and 90s. I represented Homer for 8 years. Thank you. I wouldn't have won without Homer. even though I was from Kenai, Homer was a critical part of my getting elected. So, I've been talking about it since then, but what happens is long-range plannings runs into short-term election cycles. And that is probably my biggest frustration about where we are now is that, you know, when election's over, instead of worrying about the next election, which we always do, let's worry about what we do. And it seems to me, and it may just be because I was younger then and more naive, But it seems to me that that's the way it used to work. We didn't have, you know, people talk about being in the age of information. We're in the disinformation age as much as we are in the information age. There's so much information out there, not all of it good, not all of it accurate, but there is a lot of information. You can get things out immediately through social media. And so it seems like it was easier in the past because after elections were over, we focused together, we worked across party lines, we focused on the issues as they related to us as a entire populace instead of, you know, the polarization and trying to put it in one box or another.
Maybe I could just add one thing to sort of context. You're right, we really can't depend on oil entirely, nor should we for the future, but we have been bailed out in the past by higher prices. We had more production. Now, production is the Alaska oil pipeline. If you're an optimist, you'd say it's one quarter full. If you're a pessimist, you'd say it's three quarters empty. Production is down a lot. And because expenses to produce that oil are so much higher, much of the oil on the North Slope costs more than $40 a barrel to produce, get by pipeline to Valdez, and get by tanker to refinery. So there's just not much left to tax, and because of our tax structure, you'd need oil at $110 or $120 a barrel to balance the budget. So you're right, it's got to be something more than oil as you look to the future. Last point, in more than half of the years in the past quarter century, the state has run a budget deficit and has drawn on savings. Just those savings are dwindling, so it's time. We can't go another quarter century running a deficit half the time as we have been. And with lower production, higher costs, oil's just not going to bail our ass out again.
We were in Seward, and one of the things that Larry talked about last night, we were in Seward, one of the things Larry talked about there was Norway. What's different? You know, Norway has a much, much bigger sovereign wealth or fund like our permanent fund. The difference is, when they started developing, when oil was found, they started developing oil over there. They didn't cut their taxes. They didn't spend dividends. What they did is they poured it all into this fund and allowed it to grow over time. We did the opposite. We made some spending decisions, and we're not going to be able to live on oil forever. In fact, right now, we have a significant problem, and this is part of it. And this is why the price, we probably won't see the price spikes that we've seen in the past. Jim?
Yeah, I remember living in Kenai in the 60s, and you and your brothers and sisters were running around, all 11 of you. So the Navarres are responsible for the increased school costs. But generally, I think I'm right. When they started talking about initially the permanent fund, one of the reasons was so that it could be used to pay when the rainy day came.
Right.
If I'm right, I think I remember that. And then we've gotten into the dividends, so it kind of made it. But my question is, Jay Hammond said that I'm talking about oil taxes now. It should be a third for the state, a third for the feds, and a third for the people. Are the current oil taxes roughly along that line or not?
I guess I'd say it's hard to say. If you compare the current tax structure we have to the ACES structure that we had before, today's oil prices, I think they're roughly equivalent. We do have some tax credits, but, you know, I think they're going to dial back on them a little bit. But that's part of, you know, if oil price was at $110 a barrel like it was when that was passed, we wouldn't be having any of the discussion about the tax credits or whether oil taxes are right. And, you know, some of you may remember, I opposed the initiative to repeal Senate Bill 21. And I didn't do it because I agreed with the oil tax structure. I did it because those types of issues are incredibly complex. There's a lot of nuances to them and a lot of different pieces to them. And the way where that should take place is in the legislature. where they have access to the information, they have access to consultants, they have access to the expertise that's both in the department and from the companies and the folks that they bring in order to provide that type. And so, and that's why I say that these decisions that we have to make, the structure of government that we have works and can work. It doesn't always work, but elections are going to be won and lost over exactly that. Spending decisions, tax decisions, including oil taxes, and I don't know if I can definitively say that we're getting a fair share at this time.
On those incentives, now I'm not defending the oil companies, but that's been a very successful program.
It has.
I mean, that's how Homer got natural gas, was through those incentive programs. They probably need to change it some, but that has been a very successful program in bringing in industry and natural gas.
Let me just, on the tax question, at the $40 to $50 a barrel range, when you add up the state royalty, which is 12.5%, state property tax on oil and gas property, which is another 2%, state corporate income tax on oil and gas is 9.4%, foreign production tax, the net, you know, what's left after just the expenses, the state's probably around a third. There are some who advocate the state should get a third of the gross before expenses. But I don't particularly love the oil industry either, but if you take a third of the gross, they're not going to invest money because they're going to say I'm losing money on every barrel if you take a third before expenses. So we're probably in that vicinity at net at these low prices. Close. And then the feds take 35% on federal corporate income tax.
Larry's credentials, by the way, is he was a reporter for a long time. Then he was a deputy commissioner of the Department of Revenue. He also was the federal coordinator for a gas pipeline for 5 years. And then I hired him as an oil and gas special assistant because when we're talking about AKLNG and that project, there's a lot of lead time to it, including all the studies that go into the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So hired him for that. He wasn't going to take the job because he said he wanted to focus on statewide fiscal policy issues. And I said, perfect. I'll put that in as part of your responsibilities because I'm concerned about that too, because oftentimes what you will hear as cuts at the state level are simply transfers in expenses to local governments, and it manifests as increase in taxes or a cut in services.